Hello, everybody. This is Doug with Emotional Fair Journey. I'm here with my wife, Linda.
Hello.
And we're very pleased to have with us tonight marriage and family therapist Joyce Smith. Joyce, you there?
I am certainly here. Hello.
How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing well. Yeah, how are you guys doing?
Oh, can't complain. We're getting a little bit of the sandy remnants out here, just a lot of wind and stuff, but otherwise things are going very well, thanks.
Well, good.
Yeah. Well, first of all, we wanted to just thank you. You were generous enough to write a wonderful three-part series on post-traumatic stress disorder. It was wonderful articles, and they were very well received, and we want to express our appreciation for those. So thank you very much.
Oh, you're quite welcome. It was my pleasure to do that, and it's a subject that I know very, very well, and so it was actually very easy to write it, and there's so many people that just really don't understand when these things are happening that it was nice to be able to present it in a way that a lot of people, I think, were able to understand it more easily.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Well, just to kind of give our listeners a little bit of a background, Joyce is a certified EMDR therapist, and EMDR stands for Eye Movement Desensitization and Reprocessing.
Yep.
Bit of a mouthful.
Yes, it is.
Yes, and she's also trained in TRM, which is a somatic-based therapy, which stands for Trauma Resiliency Model. Maybe we'll get in a little bit about what each of those are here, but exactly how long have you been a therapist, and what got you going? And I know you believe quite a lot in these two different types of therapy. Maybe you can just kind of explain why you are, you know, such a firm believer in their effectiveness.
Okay. I have officially been seeing clients for about, I guess, 6 years now. And prior to that, I was actually a piano teacher for about 30 years. And the course of my lessons with students, a lot of them were actually therapy before I was officially a therapist. I'd come in and they'd say, "Oh, this is a talking lesson," and things like that. And I mean, seriously. Yeah, it just kind of happened. I fought it for years because my mother's a therapist, but eventually I succumbed and said, "Okay, it's time to do this." And let's see. So a little bit about EMDR and TRIM. Basically, in dealing with my own PTSD issues, I spent literally decades with therapists talking about things, and it just didn't go away. It got to a certain point, and it just wouldn't leave. And through some of my training professionally, I was introduced to these techniques and discovered that through EMDR and through the somatic-based therapies, they address things physiologically in a way that talk therapy just doesn't get to, and things that I had been activated for literally decades, the activation went away. So that is why I wholeheartedly believe in this stuff. And also I've seen remarkable changes in my clients as well, too.
Well, that says a lot right there. I guess it's the proof's in the pudding. So I know there's a whole different wide range of therapies. So I'm imagine, you know, what works for one doesn't work for everybody. But
That is true. Yeah. Generally, these type of therapies work for situations where people have something that they just can't let go of, that they're still activated, regardless of what they've done, what they've tried, and they still keep getting triggered. These types of therapies help your brain to understand it better so that you can kind of put the pieces back together and leave it in the past. It also helps you relieve certain impulses that are still stuck inside your body that are being activated that we don't even realize that's what it is. So it just addresses it differently. And you're absolutely right. There is not one size fits all in terms of therapy.
Right. Well, very good. You kind of mentioned a word there that I think is a kind of a good segue into one thing that we wanted to discuss. And you know, earlier in the week, I had asked members of the Higher Healing group and our website to throw out some questions for you. and, you know, kind of find out what it is that they're struggling with. And as you and I kind of discussed earlier in the day today, it seemed like a lot of those had to do with triggers as a result of the affair.
Yeah.
Can we just talk about those a little bit and, you know, I guess first of all define, I think everybody knows what a trigger is, I would think, but maybe how that relates to PTSD and then how maybe some methods how some people can get past some of these triggers and their the way they affect them.
Okay. Well, there's so much more to triggers than most people are aware, that when we've experienced something that is traumatizing, and the basic definition of trauma is either too much too fast or too little for too long, but particularly in the instance of where it's too much too fast, where all of a sudden you can't believe what it is you've just seen or heard or is happening, your survival mechanism, and all this happens unconsciously without you thinking about it, it determines that it wants to make sure you're not going to be exposed to this danger ever again. So it takes that event and splits it up into a gazillion little subparticles that's every last little bit of anything that relates to that incident, be it a color, be it a shape, be it a sound that was in the air, a word you were looking at. It can be, you know, thousands of different things. And because in the moment it's overwhelming, your brain cannot consolidate all those into one cohesive memory. And so it gets filed away incorrectly into lots of little different file cabinets, but they're all still interconnected by the word danger, which relates to that particular event. So subsequently, when the traumatic event occurred and it happened to be something blue you were looking at, if you happen to see a shade of blue, your nervous system is going to say, oh, I'm back in the trauma. It's happening right now. Because your nervous system and your emotions do not have a sense of time. You're still stuck in that moment. And that's why it's so easy to access those feelings and for your nervous system to get activated. Mentally, rationally, we're able to put things on a timeline. We're able to say, yes, this is in the past. It's not happening here and now. But your nervous system, unfortunately, doesn't follow that same set of rules. So if there's anything that remotely relates to that traumatizing event, the second we pick it up, and it happens faster than we can even think about it, and our survival mechanism supersedes our cognition. And before you know it, we're activated, and you start shaking or sweating, or your heart starts pounding harder, and all those types of things, which are basically preparing you for the fight or flight mechanism, or in some cases, the freeze mechanism, which is when you perceive you can't get away and you can't fight your way out of it. So consequently, with triggers, unfortunately, with as complicated as it is with just one event, if we've had other traumas in our life, each one of those traumas has its all subsets of your hundreds of different types of triggers. And if any one of those triggers is the same as a trigger in a different trauma that occurred, your entire neural network lights up for both of those, or three of them, or four of them, or however many they are, and your nervous system goes on hyper alert for everything. So when we think we're reacting to, for example, finding out that there's been infidelity, we might actually be relating to other things that have to do with betrayal, such as some kind of sexual abuse, or physical abuse, or a car accident, or, you know, et cetera, that we're not even aware is feeding into our reactions.
So it can bring up all kinds of past pains, not just the one that is triggered. Is that what I'm
understanding? Absolutely. Absolutely. In particular, the people that take longer to let go of this stuff and have stronger reactions, it's usually because there's other things that are fueling it as well.
That probably haven't been addressed.
Yes, that have not been addressed.
Addressed in the past.
Yeah, things that have not been addressed. Or what I've also seen happen is there's somebody who has addressed a lot of what's happened in the past. But remember I said there are like hundreds of little triggers where they might not have gotten to every single one of those. And then when you have something as earth-shaking as finding out about infidelity, suddenly those little teeny tiny triggers that were something become bigger than life. Mm-hmm. And so they just jump to the foreground, but you don't necessarily realize, again, that it's old stuff. So, yeah, and you can work on it, and this is a great way to work on what hasn't been completed before. Sort of a bizarre blessing in disguise, so to speak.
So is this why in a lot of traditional therapies they get so much into people's past and their childhood and all that sort of thing?
Yeah, there's a piece of that, that does that as well, to come to a different understanding. The problem with traditional therapies is when they're talking about it, they're not getting into the physiology of it. Mm-hmm. And if we could heal things just by talking about it, we would have been healed a long time ago, right? So if you're still being triggered, the talking obviously isn't the key to make this thing work.
And I also believe the awareness of what is actually happening. I think a lot of our listeners or people who visit the blog were almost like set free when they started reading your articles of, oh my gosh, mm-hmm. that's how I feel. That's why I'm sweating and shaking and I'm not crazy. And I think for the cheater to truly understand that we're not, these triggers don't come up because we're trying to punish the other person. It's just something that happens that we really have a difficult time controlling.
And, yeah, absolutely.
And I think if the cheater was aware of what was actually going through our bodies, our brains, and so forth, maybe they would be able to be a little bit more sympathetic to when we were going crazy.
Oh, absolutely, because it's not because we're crazy. It's because our neurobiology is taking over. And, yeah, sure, it helps to see that there is a real reason. There's a physiological reason why we're responding the way we are or reacting. And for somebody else to understand that it's physiological, like the cheater, as opposed to saying, oh, come on, get over it, we're done, let's move on.
Right.
Well, yeah, except your nervous system isn't done. Your nervous system is back to where the betrayal happened. And every time that there's a new piece of information that gets revealed, it's like starting over at square one again.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so then the physical symptoms of the sweating, the shaking, the dry mouth,
mm-hmm.
those are all a result.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, I always wonder why I would always start shaking. And I still shake. And and it's all due to that, to the physiological impact.
Oh, absolutely. And shaking is actually a good thing because it's releasing some of the energy that's been stuck in your body all this time. Yeah, and it is a good thing, and if you can just sort of embrace it, sometimes you'll find that there are times when you'll feel the shaking will start to come, and if you want to, you can consciously stop it, but if you allow it just to happen, then it becomes a release to get some of that stuff out of your body.
Anything else on triggers, Linda?
Gosh, you could go forever on triggers.
Well, let me look here real quick at some of the questions that maybe some of the readers had. But it looks like a couple of them, for instance, here, how do you stop the thoughts as they escalate out of control over something you know isn't happening? I don't know if that's considered a trigger necessarily, but I guess it could be.
Yeah, well, sure. Well, something has triggered those thoughts.
Right.
And yes, you logically know it's happening or not happening, but that's when we get into the physiological part that ties into the emotional part that is still stuck where something happened before. So when you start to feel yourself getting activated, and that's really the first step to beginning to take control over this, is notice where you're sensing it in your body. This is where some of the somatic stuff comes into play, somatic meaning body sensation. And if you notice, is your jaw clenching? Are your teeth clenched? Is your body shaking? Do you feel tightness in your legs? You know, where are you feeling it? And if you can begin to get in touch with that bit by bit, you will recognize it sooner. And as soon as you do that, then if you do some of the grounding exercises, because grounding is very much about bringing your cognition back on board and bringing your brain back in the room. Because what you're responding to is either something that happened before or something you're afraid is going to happen in the future, not what's occurring in the moment while you're right there. So what you want to do is get in touch with what is happening in that moment. You know, a real good places to start with is if you're sitting down, notice, or even standing up, wherever you are, notice your points of contact from your body to the chair, to the floor. With your arm, notice how it's being supported and held. Notice the texture of what's holding you or you're standing on. Notice the temperature. Notice the sounds in the room. It's a lot of mindfulness, which is very big. Right. Mindfulness is another name for something that's been around for thousands of years. It's kind of the catchword of current day. But the bottom line, what you're doing is coming back in the room. Another thing you can do is to engage your cognition, because remember what I said before is your nervous system hijacks your cognition. So after it's been hijacked and you start to get activated, that's where you say, okay, let me bring my cognition back on board. Let's rein this thing in. What's going on right now? Let me look around the room. I'm going to find five green things right now. And then you look around the room and you spot those things. And it's a distraction technique to get your brain away from thinking about the intrusive thoughts. It's also getting you in touch with what's happening here and now and getting your cognition back on board, which then will begin to supersede what's happening in your neurobiology.
So in essence, it's both techniques that you just mentioned are basically just controlling your thoughts and getting away from past events and bringing them to present.
Yeah, basically. And it's controlling your thoughts and also getting in touch with your body sensations too.
Right.
Because your body sensations are what get triggered, and they're also what can bring you back.
Now, normally when you're conducting this type of therapy with somebody or doing exercises, does this take a lot of practice? How long does it take somebody to get somewhat proficient at this?
Oh, it doesn't take that long at all. And I actually have on my website a couple of guided meditations that have bilateral music in the background. Bilateral is a basic premise of EMDR, which is where it shifts back and forth from left and right sides of your body, and it helps connect your rational with your emotional, unrational side of your brain to make sense out of it. It's a way of being able to integrate things more easily. And I have one guided meditation there called Grounding, Resourcing, and Peaceful Place, which has a lot of these techniques included in it. And after you've done them a few times, you can do them on your own anywhere. The bilateral music does help to bring that in as well. I have another one, a new one that... I'm sorry?
Does the music then help you focus more on...
The music helps you it helps you integrate what the experience is, what you're thinking about. And honestly, it doesn't have to be music. It can be any kind of bilateral movement where you can be, there's something called a butterfly hug, where you're basically hugging yourself and you can tap back and forth, left, right, with your fingers on your arms. And that works as well. The music is good because you don't have to be doing anything in that moment. It's just kind of doing it. And when I work with my clients, sometimes we'll use music. I also use these. They're basically like vibrating pulsers. They hold one in each hand, and there's a vibration that shifts back and forth, left and right. Or sometimes we'll use lights. The EMDR eye movement part of it is because initially, when it was first discovered, they thought you had to use your eyes to look back and forth from left to right and follow somebody's fingers. And that's a technique that's still being used. And it doesn't have to be just eye movements. So the music takes the place of that. And when you have your eyes closed, it often helps you get into it more fully. And you can also focus more because you're not looking at the external stimuli at the same time.
Yeah, I've started meditating, I don't know, maybe about a year ago. And I've done it sporadically over that period of time. When I first started, I always had a hard time. I mean, my brain was just going everywhere, and I found that it took a little bit of practice to kind of rein your brain back in, where you don't have a million thoughts going through your brain at one time.
Right. Well, your brain will have different thoughts that will crop up,
sure.
And just make it okay.
Right.
Yeah, it's okay. And one technique I've heard of is when your brain starts going off somewhere, you just say thinking, 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 and then it brings you back in again. But yeah, our brains are going to go off unless you're a Tibetan monk or something. We don't have that kind of practice. So yes, your brain is going to go off and then you bring it back in again. And generally when you root things in body sensation and you come back to noticing the rhythm of your breath, again, noticing what's happening in the moment, that helps bring you back in again.
Yeah, that's what I had learned. It was the breath was the key. Everybody breathes, and you kind of just... And that's the one certain thing while you're sitting there is that you're going to be breathing. So you kind of center yourself on that and come back. So.
Absolutely. And if rather than saying, okay, I'm breathing really fast, I need to slow down my breathing, if you look at it from a different perspective and you just say, notice the rhythm of your breath. Well, when you notice the rhythm of your breath, you're going to notice that you're breathing very quickly. And just by noticing it, you're inherently going to start to slow it down.
Now, getting back to, I guess, specifically how this relates to infidelity and stuff.
Okay.
I assume that you have some clients that suffered from infidelity.
Yes, I have.
Use this type of therapy on them, but or with them, I should say. And it's not voodoo. But
no, it's not.
I mean, a lot of people just have questions like, how long am I going to feel this way? You know, do you ever get past the anger? You know, am I ever going to feel good enough? That kind of stuff. What's your experience with those types of questions, maybe as it relates to the therapy you do and maybe, you know, just in general? You know, what's your experience with how long it takes somebody to
get from that? Well, everybody has their own individual process. And as I mentioned earlier, a lot of it has to do with how much prior trauma you've had. It is also feeding into this. Another piece of it is how empathetic your partner is. And I've had several clients that have discovered that when they get activated by something, if they're able to have a conversation with their partner in a way that is non-accusatory, not blaming, just this is how I'm feeling when this happens, and the other person can acknowledge that, that what can start off as being really difficult, by the end of it, they end up feeling closer, and they've gotten through it and gotten a better understanding of the other person's perspective.
Right.
So as far as how long it can take, and the general thing that's out there says it's roughly 2 to 4 years. It can be sooner, it can be longer. A lot of it has to do with how stuck you are and how often you keep repeating the same tapes. And for some people, it can feel very comfortable to hold on to the negativity because it's something they can control, it's something that they can hold on to, and it feels normal in that moment. That it's a way of being able to draw attention to themselves sometimes. Look at what I've suffered. Look at what has happened. And it really takes a certain amount of trust in yourself, trust in your partner, which takes a while to build, and trust only comes with consistency and time, which, you know, is a big one. But just to sidestep on that for a moment, the consistency, it's so important for the offending partner to make good on things they say they're going to do. And it could be as simple as saying, oh, yeah, I'm going to take out the trash after dinner. Well, if you don't take out the trash after dinner, the wife says, aha, you lied to me again.
Right.
And, it could be the husband, I'm sorry, the person who's been betrayed. I know I made that faux pas in my article. There are plenty of men who have women who have been the ones that have been, who have betrayed them.
Saying what you mean. Keeping you.
Yes, okay, thank you. Yes, yeah. It's so important to just follow through with what you say you're going to do, because when you've been betrayed, it feels like there's nothing you can trust. You can't trust your own opinions on things. You can't trust the reality of anything. You know, what is real? How do I know what's right, what isn't? And the only way you begin to establish that is bit by bit having things that you see happen. A little bit like when you have babies that are in high chairs and they reach this point where they start dropping things on the floor. And you pick it up, and they drop it on the floor again. And they keep doing that because they want to test out and see, what's going to happen if I drop this? If I let go, is it really going to fall on the floor? And it takes several repetitions to begin to assimilate that information. I know that's a very different example, but in many ways it's very similar. We need the consistency. We need to see what's happening. Part of healing is, at a certain point, being willing to make your peace with what happened. And what happened, happened. And basically, there's going to be one of two choices. You're either going to find a way to make your peace with it and move on with your life and do what you can to try and regain closeness and a new level of closeness and intimacy, or you're going to discover this wasn't the relationship that works for you, and so you part. But even then, you still have to work on your own stuff because it's going to carry you through into your next relationship. So
right.
You've got to deal with all those issues of betrayal, which, you know, can stem back to things like when your parents got divorced and one
right.
of them left. That feels like betrayal and being abandoned, which are very similar feelings to what it feels like when there's infidelity.
Doug and I were talking last week, you know, he wanted to write like a guide for men, you know, and I told him that cheaters do not realize all the implications and the healing that has to be done. I mean, it seems so very black and white, I think, to the cheater, okay, I'm back, I'm transparent,
mm-hmm.
I'm done. I can, you know, we can move on. But it's like all the little things. I mean, it's just, it's a daily
battle.
You know, as I said, just, you know, they have a hard time
mm-hmm.
understanding that something as much as a color or a smell will
mm-hmm.
cause a trigger, and that our brain is going crazy, and then eventually we have to say something, you know, and
right.
It is a way that the cheater responds back to us. If we feel safe,
mm-hmm.
you know, telling them about our trigger and they listen and can, you know, put themselves in our shoes for a moment, then we are able to move on. But if you're hearing, you need to get over this, you need to get over this, or here we go again, we can't move, you know, we're stuck.
Yeah.
And,
well, that's absolutely true. And one of the most important things in healing on both sides of it is to have empathy,
mm-hmm.
in particular for the person who is the cheater. When they can begin to empathize with the feelings of their partner, that's a huge step towards healing together as a couple. Yeah, and one of the things that tends to happen with this is when you've got one partner that is the cheater, and then they come to a point for whatever reason, either they just can't stand anymore, they say something, or the other person discovers something. In that moment, usually the person who's the cheater has this tremendous sense of guilt that they've been holding for a long time. And it's like they give you this ball of guilt to the person who's been betrayed and said, oh, I feel so much better, this is off my shoulders. And in that moment, the person who's been betrayed holds on to this thing and says, well, what am I supposed to do with this? And there's all kinds of, yeah. And so for the person who is a betrayer, in certain sense, it's easier to say, okay, I'm done, let's move on. And often there's a lot of guilt and shame on their part as well, particularly when they begin to realize the depth to how much pain they've caused their partner. And some people are willing to hold that pain of their partner, and some people can't handle it, and they create distance. So there's a lot of ways people deal with this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. It's a fabulous thing to have a manual of sorts for the person who is the cheater to know how to best help the person who's been betrayed, because there are so many little things.
Yeah.
Right.
I think that, you know, we've had our blog, it'll be, 3 years in December or whatever, and
mm-hmm.
of all the people we've talked to and have made comments and all that sort of thing, of the people whose spouses have definitely stopped their affair,
mm-hmm.
the biggest problem for their spouses in healing is that the cheater basically didn't help them and had
yeah.
no empathy, like what we've just discussed. They're mm-hmm. the ones that are kind of cutting their own throats, so to speak, because they want to move on. Their spouse won't move on until they talk about it, they don't want to talk mm-hmm. about it. So it's kind of like a vicious circle, and it's just... It is. Right.
And part of talking about it is that it's really important to have a timeline of events to understand what happened. It's like in retrospect, the person who's been betrayed can then begin to say, oh, well, I had a feeling this was going on, or this seemed kind of weird. Now I understand why that was happening. Well, there's a piece of that. The other piece of it is that the person that's been betrayed wasn't there to witness what was going on. So there's this huge chunk of time that has big questions to say, what was happening when I wasn't there? And as far as getting that information from the person who is the cheater, it can be a little tricky because there's part of that person that wants to know everything, and then there's reaches a certain point where knowing everything isn't necessarily helpful. It's more like pouring salt into a wound. And that really varies from one person to another in terms of how much information they really need to have in order to be able to understand and let things go.
Right.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that changes. Mm-hmm. You know, at first you think you want to, and then as time goes on, you realize how difficult it is knowing things, how that mm-hmm. produces triggers. And it's like, as I said, it's what you think you knew after 6 months and then after 2 years, you know, you change. And
yeah.
It's almost like starting over at every stage.
In some ways it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in some ways it absolutely is. There's certain things that didn't seem important before that suddenly seem very important now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a process. It's not fun, but getting through it can produce incredible closeness and intimacy that wasn't there before if both partners are willing to work through this together.
Absolutely. Looking here on the list for any other questions here. I know we talked a little bit about trust,
mm-hmm.
but wanted to get your thoughts on that. You know, I guess a lot of people, betrayed spouses in particular, they want to trust, or they think they do, but they never can get that trust back to the level that
mm-hmm.
it once was. And yeah. there's also another set of people who don't want to take the risk thinking
mm-hmm.
that it might happen again.
Sure.
Vulnerability.
Pardon me?
Vulnerability.
Vulnerability,
mm-hmm.
okay.
Yeah, very much.
I've been reading a lot about that lately.
Yeah. But, you know, how do you get, you know, what do you say to somebody like that?
Well, as I said before, it takes time and consistency to begin to develop that. And at a certain point, the person who's been betrayed has to take a little bit of a leap of faith to say, well, maybe this isn't going to happen again. Maybe they really do mean what they say. And at that point, that's when you stop and say, okay, what are the things that show me that this person is different? How do I know that they're not the person they were before? Because usually when there's an affair going on, the person who's the cheater has withdrawn in a number of ways. And that withdrawal can take the form of sometimes sexually in terms of performance. It can be show up in things like in terms of how one person kisses the other. There's a difference between a quick little peck or a more intimate kiss. It can be the look in somebody's eye. And a lot of times you can look in somebody's eyes and tell if they're telling the truth or not, or tell if they're sincerity. I've seen with couples that I've worked with, when the person who's been betrayed is talking about the pain that they've gone through, and the cheater has such a look of pain in their eye to see what they have caused. And seeing that in your partner, I think, can help have you have a sense that they understand what happened.
Sure.
And that can help. Let me think other things with trust.
It all comes down to, you know, is like the actions that the person's doing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, words are
cheap. Yeah, actions are huge, absolutely huge. And at a certain point, it takes a certain amount of willingness to say, what good is it serving me to hold on to this anymore? I know people who have done things like put Net Nanny on their computer so that they can stop the cheater from going to X, Y, and Z. And that carries a real mixed bag with it, because on one hand, it's stopping the person from physically being able to do it. Truth be known, they can use somebody else's computer somewhere else if they want to.
Sure.
But what it also does is it keeps perpetuating the idea that there's something there to have to worry about. And at a certain point, if you can reach the point of being able to say, you know what, I just have to trust that they're not going to do this, and you take nanny off, then suddenly the person who's the cheater feels more trusted, which makes them feel that it's easier to have intimacy with you because you trust them, and things of that nature. And all in all, it's a process, and at a certain point, there's some vulnerability that's going to happen in order to be able to make it through. And is it there a guarantee that you're not going to be hurt again? No. But as far as life goes, there are no guarantees other than being born, dying, and having to pay taxes. Other than that, you never know.
That's right.
So, you know, like there's that expression, I was trying to say there's that expression that says it's better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all.
Uh-huh.
So if you still keep holding on to all the pain and being afraid to trust and being afraid to open up, that's going to affect your quality of life. And is that something that you really want to continue to have?
Right.
And if you reach the point where you say, you know, this isn't any way to live life, I just can't do this anymore. And you got to take that blind leap of faith and start focusing on the things that show you that that person is with you, that they are connected, that they're not off somewhere else. And you know when somebody is connected with you, you have a sense of that. You can feel it. You can feel the vibration of it, and you can tell when somebody's sloughing you off or when they're really connected. So it's shifting your focus a little bit, like I discussed in the article of scanning the environment, how when we're hypervigilant, when we're looking for danger, and we only take in 4% of what we're seeing out there, that's all we're going to see is danger. And if we start to shift our focus to look for positive things, suddenly we're going to discover there's a lot of positive stuff out there. And does it take a conscious effort to do that? Absolutely. And bit by bit, that becomes a habit to start shifting your focus. Or when you notice that you're focusing on something negative, shift your focus to something positive. Because as you keep going over the same loop over and over of the negative things that happen, you're reinforcing that neural pathway in your brain so it can get there quicker and quicker. And what you want to do is kind of short-circuit that and think of something else instead. And there's that very poignant video, which I will not talk about how you find out because we don't want to give it away. But in the third article about methods to heal and cope, there is a very poignant video. It's only like a minute and 20 seconds long that directly addresses the concept of what you're looking for is what you see.
Yeah, I don't even think that long. I think like 30 seconds.
The poignant part of it is 30 seconds, yes.
Yeah, it's an interesting video because it's, you know, it works. I don't know if that's the right word to use, but it's you have to try it out because you might be surprised what you see or you don't see, I guess.
Mm-hmm. That's true. So. Absolutely.
Linda, I thought I heard you chime in there. Did you have something to say?
No, I didn't.
Oh, okay.
I did, but I didn't.
She answered it. Okay.
Yeah.
One of the other questions that comes up quite a bit, too, is the feeling mm-hmm. of not being good enough.
Oh, that's exactly the one I was mm-hmm. looking at.
Okay.
okay.
You know, a lot of comparing mm-hmm. to the
right.
parts, you know, that's done quite a bit. So can you address maybe how someone can kind of get past that?
Sure. Basically, something like this will hit upon all of your insecurities, all right? And whatever your issues are, they're going to come through loud and clear. So once again, it's a golden opportunity to begin to deal with some of those things. But, yeah, there's a natural tendency to want to compare, to say, well, what did this other person have that I didn't have? And in truth, this other person, that the affair partner, it's in many ways, it's a fantasy affair. It's not real life. They're not in there day to day dealing with paying the bills or having to fix things around the house or take the trash out or take care of the kids. So it's a very unreal environment. And in the case that it's an unreal environment, it's also an unreal relationship. So there's a lot about it that is not genuine, and that true intimacy includes everything. It's not just having all the good stuff. It's being able to go through the stuff that's not so much fun. So as far as ways to feel better about yourself, there's things like, you know, doing exercise that gets the dopamines going in your brain, which dopamine feels good, which is part of what fairs are about. They're hitting dopamine centers in your brain. It is a chemical response that happens when people have affairs. So you can get a similar feeling when you're exercising. When you eat well, makes a difference. Doing nice things for yourself. Like go out and get a pedicure. If you're a woman, or if you're a man and you're into that too, that's fine. But just do something nice for yourself. Treat yourself, because part of feeling like you're not good enough gets perpetuated when you keep saying, well, I don't deserve this, I don't deserve that. Well, what fed into that? There may be old issues that are feeding into the concept that I'm not good enough, that I don't deserve to have good things happen because bad things have happened to me before, and here's just another example of that. So again, shift your focus. Look for something positive. Go and volunteer some time with an organization somewhere. You will be very appreciated, which is part of what we all want. It's also really important for the cheater to do a lot of things to acknowledge the person who's been betrayed, to notice when they've done something nice for them, or comment, gee, you look really handsome, or you look really beautiful today, or thank you so much for remembering me, or, you know, I thought about you the other day. Things to let each other know that you're still on each other's mind, because part of the not feeling good enough feels like the other person didn't want to take the time to think about you. So it's real important to know that you're still being thought about. They can do things like leave little notes around the house, or a note can suddenly show up in somebody's car. And it's these little things that make a huge difference in terms of the interplay. Sometimes people that feel that they're not good enough, they can get so stuck in that they realize that it takes two to make a relationship. So sometimes if you're willing to step out a little bit and do something nice for the other person, it makes the other person that much more willing to do something nice for you, and they kind of feed off each other. So it's a process. It takes time. You can make a list of all your good attributes. What are the things you do feel positive about? What are some accomplishments that you've had in your life? And, you know, who are people that are important to you? What are some things that somebody has said before that's made you feel good about yourself, be it a friend, a teacher, a coach, or whatever it is? Everybody has something in their life that they've done where they felt good. And it's important to begin to start putting all those in your arsenal, to be able to point to those when you're feeling bad and not good enough and say, well, but, you know, there was that time when I did this, and, yeah, I felt pretty good about that. And again, it's shifting that focus from the negative to the positive.
Right.
And it takes effort and a conscious, a real discipline and consciousness to be able to make that shift. And it's a little bit like everybody says they want to lose weight, right? Well, what is involved in losing weight? There's two basic components. There's exercise and there's eating differently. You can think about it. Is that going to do it for you? No. You can go to the gym and still not do anything, and that's still not going to help. It's the actual effort, and the initial efforts do take more discipline and more conscious effort, and the more you begin to do these things on a regular basis, the more it starts to become second nature and gets easier, and then you feel better, and it's a cycle that feeds on itself.
Yeah, I think it's those people that do those things on a regular basis that end up having a better relationship after such a trauma
mm-hmm.
than what they had before it.
Oh, absolutely. There's so much more appreciation.
Or whatever. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They just show it more.
Yeah, absolutely. And everybody wants to be appreciated and acknowledged and to feel loved. And the more things that you can do like that with your partner, the more that's just going to help increase your intimacy. We all want to feel accepted. One thing I was thinking of is that the times, getting back to the triggered thing again, that when the person who's been betrayed gets triggered, one of the best things the cheater can say to them is, what do you need from me right now? What can I do for you? And it could be something, that's where you really have to think about what you need. I need a hug. I need you to tell me what you love about me. I need you to tell me that you're always going to be here. I need you just to hold me while I cry. I need you to understand what I'm saying to you. You know, there's all kinds of different things it can be, that it's important to communicate what those needs are, which a lot of people don't communicate those needs up front, and that's part of what causes the distance between each other, which then causes the need of wanting to feel that somewhere, and then it sort of becomes like a magnet somewhere else. So
I think
so
the
it's important.
During the trigger is to justify their actions rather than giving the betrayer what they need. Normally, the reason I think the triggers happen is because we do feel insecure about something. It could be maybe they didn't say hello the way they usually did. It's just really minute things, but really what we need is for them to come closer to us.
Yes,
rather than
absolutely.
Becoming justifying or defense or moving away or any kind of anger. And I think it just takes a long time for the betrayer to get through to the cheater. This is what I need. You know, you need somehow to go beyond what you normally do, put away those old defenses and those old habits, and try something different and come towards us.
Yeah, and if basically
it's very hard
like
for them to do.
If they can go back to those beginning courting days, what was it like at the very beginning when you were starting to show your love and affection for somebody, to show that they mattered, that they were special to you, that they were accepted? All those things are really important. Absolutely, you're completely 1,000% right, Linda, that it can be something as simple as somebody saying hello in a different way, or maybe you don't quite make eye contact, and then suddenly the person who's been betrayed, their nervous system goes into hyper alert saying, oh, he's having an affair again. When consciously you know that's not happening, but your nervous system is saying, oh, yeah? And so that's when it's really important for the cheater to say, I can see that you're feeling activated right now. What can I do for you? What got it going? Is that there's a dynamic between two people as far as being understood. When we feel that we're not being understood by the other person, we do one of two things. We either say it louder because we think it's going to get in better, or we pull away. And then we get this dance going back and forth. When we say something louder, the other person will either say what they're saying louder, and then that goes back and forth, or the other person pulls away. So then we start chasing after them, and they're still running away. And the way to get around that is to try and say things in a calm way that you just can hear what the other person has to say without taking it as blame. If you can speak from your own experience about when this happens, I feel this way. When I saw that you didn't make eye contact, I felt unimportant. I felt like I didn't mean anything to you. You know, whatever it is that you can get in touch with your own personal feelings, and in conversations with other people, they will take in that information so much more when you talk from your own personal experience and your feelings versus saying, you didn't pay any attention to me. It's received very differently.
But I think for a long time, like I would say, I just feel this way. Well, that's crazy. And then that's, okay, then I back down. You know what I mean? It came to a point where you can't tell the betrayed spouse that any of their feelings are crazy, because to them they're very real.
They're extremely real. And at that point, the betrayer can come in and say, I can see you're feeling upset. You know, what do you need? Mm-hmm. What will help you feel better? And without questioning it, just accept it, because the person who's upset needs to be acknowledged that they're in pain.
And I think that's why a majority of the people who have these questions are stuck. I think it's just the way that the cheater is handling their triggers.
That's a big piece of it, absolutely, communication between people. Mm-hmm. And also if there's old unresolved trauma, it absolutely
right.
feeds into this stuff. Mm-hmm. But yes, the cheater can help this process immensely by taking full responsibility for their actions, because there's absolutely nothing the betrayed person did to cause the cheater to go out and do what they did. They did not hold a gun to their head and say, you are going to do this or I'm going to kill you. That didn't happen. So the cheater has to take full recognition for their actions. It has nothing to do with the person who was betrayed.
Yeah. Right. And that's a hard thing for a betrayed to really understand
mm-hmm.
and believe. You know?
Yeah.
Because they do think it's about them, and
mm-hmm.
something to get over, I think.
Yeah. And something we haven't even gotten into at all is the whole idea of addictions, that people who have problems with sex addictions, love addictions, the whole internet thing has gone through the roof. It's the largest form of addiction that's happening because it's accessible, it's affordable, although it can escalate depending upon what you're doing, but in a lot of cases it's free. There's a lot of anonymity that happens and so forth, and there's other types of sex, love, romance addictions. And for people who are involved in that, there's actually a physical disconnect in their brain between their actions and the ramifications of it. It's filled with just as many justifications as any other addiction, as drugs and alcohol and gambling. There's always justifications that, oh, they just don't understand, it's no big deal. Mm-hmm. And those people often in childhood grew up in highly restricted environments or environments where there was some type of abuse or abandonment from one of their parents. And as a child, you cannot deal with that type of betrayal from your parents. You need to feel safe. And so your brain physiologically makes a disconnect, because the idea that a parent is abusive or a parent leaves you, you can't handle it. So your brain does not equate now parent with abandoning. They're two different things. And then that ends up carrying through in life in addictions, where the consequences of what your actions are not linked up.
Hmm.
So, and they can be, but again, it's a process.
Yeah. Linda sees a whole lot of that at her school that she teaches at, where kind of a lower socioeconomic school, and there's a lot of
abuse
and a lot of family issues and
trauma.
Mm-hmm. And one of the counselors was telling Linda what there's actually a
well, the lobe in the back of your brain. I have a little girl who has experienced severe trauma, and her processing is very slow because she's always has that fear flight.
Mm-hmm.
So she's always in a state of fear, so she cannot focus and process things. And so we're working on that with her. And, you know, one of the things the counselor was telling me is like, oh, I know exactly what you're talking about. You know, just like she feels this way, and, you know, not that I said anything about my situation, but I just really could understand everything that she was telling me, what this little girl was going through.
My guess is she lives in a household where there's an alcoholic parent or there's some kind of
drugs.
Ongoing physical drugs, okay?
Drugs
basically, where
sexual abuse.
Yeah, the sexual abuse, all that stuff. It's in an environment where you never know what's going to happen, when the rug's going to be pulled out from under you, and so your nervous system is stuck on high in hypervigilance. And when that happens, the hippocampus, which is part of your brain that deals with assimilating information in a way that makes sense, goes offline because you're stuck in survival mode.
And
one of the things for her is same kind of thing, grounding techniques, finding ways to be able to calm your nervous system. It's not going to change the environment she's in, unfortunately, but there are some techniques that she can use in the meantime to begin to help herself calm down a bit. But yeah, there's tons of this stuff, and there's multi-generational things where it goes from one generation to another, be it, you know, the physical abuse, be it the alcoholism, whatever it is. And so forth and on it goes until somebody finally stands up and says, it's time to change this.
All right. Well, I'm sorry to say, Joyce, I think we're running out of time here. I think we could probably continue talking for another few hours, I'm sure.
Probably.
Yeah. Maybe pick it up somewhere here down the road in the future, but we're kind of
sure.
limited as far as time goes. But
yeah.
we really do want to thank you.
Well, you're welcome. There's one more thing I wanted to just briefly say on the bilateral meditations. I have a new one that I've added there that's on the website called Alleviating Emotional Pain. And that's an exercise which I have had tremendous success with a number of people who have been using it and quite pleased with the results. And it also has the bilateral music, and it's different than the grounding and resourcing one.
How long
so all
do those
things
last, just for our listeners? How long does
the meditations?
Yeah.
The grounding and resourcing and also the alleviating emotional pain, both of those have about 12 minutes of a guided meditation portion, and then there's about two extra minutes of music afterwards. And you'll be amazed how fast that time goes once you're in there.
I do 15 to 30 minutes, and it goes really quick. So that's not very long at all. So, and your website, by the way, is www.joycesmithmft, and that's for marriage and family therapist.com.
Mm-hmm. That's it.
joycesmithmft.com. And then on your site, you've got these guided meditations along with some other articles and information and resources and such. And certainly, if anybody wants to contact Joyce, there's a place on her website or a contact page or form or whatever that they can do that, correct?
Right. There's a contact form. My email address is all over there. Feel free to send an email. Contact me through the website, and there is a lot of additional information and so forth in there.
Fantastic.
So,
thanks again so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. My pleasure.